Welcome, everybody, to a new edition of the Hot Rod Blues Podcast. I am your host, Sean Burton, along with the two co-hosts.
Javier Agustin, Bomber Steel Customs.
I almost forgot I had a microphone. Yeah, this is Sean Young, Kingfish Metalworks. And who have you brought with us today, young man?
I have brought Stephen Mancuso. Nobody knows who Stephen is. No, that's all right. No, I'm just kidding.
It happens.
No, yeah. So Stephen and I go back 10 years?
At least, yeah.
Yeah, at least. But about 10 years or so. He used to be in insurance, but now he's in fun stuff.
I grew up.
Lots of fun stuff, yeah. So, welcome. Thanks for coming. I appreciate it, man. So
I love the facility here. It's really awesome.
Yeah, right. So we got to say where we're at. We're in a tin can. We're in a tin can.
We're actually in two tin cans.
Yeah, that's right.
Tin can.
We're in a tin can inside of a tin can. We're like a turducken.
Okay. if turducken was filled with four gross guys and sweating Memphis, July.
Exactly. So we are inside of Sean and Javi's shop, which is a Kwanzaa hut. And then we're inside of an Airstream trailer, which is what Javi...
What year?
Javi does.
Yeah. What year?
Yeah, what
this
year?
This is a 69.
69? 69. I was born.
Yeah.
Perfect. Yeah, fantastic. Right. Yeah.
That explains 69. A lot. I didn't know that.
Yeah, right.
This is a 69 land yacht, 26 footer. They've affectionately named her Ellie. And we have to talk about her because we're sitting inside.
Yeah, right. it just doesn't sound right. Yeah.
It's tradition that you name them. If families usually name them if they have them, they're become heirlooms. But I actually, unofficial company policy, I don't start working on them until I make them choose a name.
Really?
Well, doesn't have to be a boy or a girl. It's we're non-binary around here. So the only ones and zeros I care about are if the check's clear. But they're a really great family out of Knoxville, and I was really excited to take this in.
Yeah,
it's a big jump for the business, and they've really signed off on a lot of cool stuff. On our channel, we'll do some. If you follow us on social, we'll talk more about some of the stuff. But I was
on Hot Rod Blues.
No. The business. Bomber Steel Customs.
Bomber Steel Customs.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's right. So anyway, that's not what we're doing here today.
Right. But we got to talk about because it probably looks like we're in a tin can.
The real host is Ellie, because it is like literally 120 degrees outside of Ellie. And it dawned on me today when we were looking for a location that we could just do the little portable AC thing and test out this new insulation.
Yeah.
From
it needs some more back here, but other than that.
Yeah. No, this is no lie. That's sheep's wool from New Zealand.
Is it really?
Yeah. Wow. When I said when I said they were cool, the clients were cool, they signed off on this.
Wow.
It's sustainable. You can touch it with your hands off. It's all kinds of good. And I can tell you more about it after the show.
Very interesting. Yeah. Well, so we're here to talk about you, Stephen. So
that's really what I like to hear.
Yeah. So let's kind of start back at the beginning. Why not? Right.
Yeah. So Sean and I met with, I was selling insurance, and I specialized, I was a Haggerty broker for Haggerty Insurance, and specializing in race teams and large car collections and car museums. And so Sean and I got hooked up by a coworker who worked with your wife.
Yeah.
And she was like, well, if you're going to be doing cards, you got to know Sean. And so Sean and I became, fast friends. I think you invited me to a car show the first time we met.
Yeah. I think you went with me that first Saturday, yeah. I think, like right after we met.
Right away.
Yeah.
And then we went to the Selmer car show, which was a tragedy. And we kind of bonded through all that. And he introduced me to some of my other really close friends. And we've just kind of stayed in contact. Now he's my photographer whenever it comes to high-end auction cars that we send all over the world. And he's done a phenomenal job certainly gotten a lot of kudos for that. So I was in this insurance business, and one of my clients was the Tupelo Automobile Museum in Tupelo, Mississippi. And I was having a conversation with this lady one day, and I said, you've inherited this from your husband. You've got your health. You got houses in multiple places that are not here in Tupelo. What the hell are you doing? And she said, well, I'd really like to sell it, and I want to sell it to Jay Leno.
Whoa.
Excuse me.
That's literally a name drop. Would you say?
Yeah, right. Yeah.
That was a name drop.
Yeah, to Jay Leno.
And I found that oddly specific. And I said, well, you've got a Tucker and a Duesenberg along with 200 other cars. I can probably get him on the phone.
Yeah, he's a big fan of the Doozies, right?
Yeah. He basically, I my wife and I put together a portfolio of just kind of handpicked some cars I thought may have caught his eye. I went on Apple and did the whole thing and sent it to him. And about 4 days after it arrived, I got a phone call. And it was him. And he said, hey, it's Jay Leno. Hey, what are you trying to do?
Oh, my God. It's like he's in the room. Yeah. How do you do that?
That's my best Jay Leno. It stops right there.
Your chin got bigger when you started.
Yeah, it does. It's really weird. My hair turns gray. It's great. But he was like, you know, I like five cars out of this. And I said, well, five cars aren't for sale. We have 286 cars if you'd like to join us. And not to mention a building and you know, what it is. And so, and we had 4,000 signs to sell. So, so he was like, call Wayne Carini. He knows what to do. So look, I'm in the dark in this situation. All of a sudden I've sold cars on the side, but nothing like this.
What year was this?
This was 2017 when we started the process.
So Wayne's just now ramping up on his show pretty big.
Yeah, he was already in 40 countries, 40 right. million viewers a week. Yeah. I mean, it was massive. And so I contacted his office. His secretary Sue was wonderful, and she was like, "I'll put you right through." I got Wayne on the phone immediately, and he was like, "I'm on my way to Tupelo, I guess." So it took about 6 days later. He shows up, and he comes in, and we spent a 3 days together, and drank a lot, and talked a lot of stories, and after meeting with Jane, we both advised her that selling it to one individual was an absolute needle in a needle stack.
Yeah, it wasn't really feasible.
It's just not feasible. But a lot of people come to us with those kind of suggestions. And so we suggested that she go with a no reserve auction. And she said, well, I want to give everything to charity. I don't want any money from it. And so that's where it started. And so we interviewed three auction houses.
Yeah, because the museum was originally set up for a charity, was it not?
It was.
That was the plan.
It was moved into a charity back in 2006, I think, right before her husband had passed away. And his idea or his desire was that the collection would stay together. It would continue on forever. But he failed to leave, you know, enough cash to be able to do right. that. She was spending to the tune of about $500,000 a year just to
maintain
place open.
Them. Yeah.
Car museums in general, if you know, once the driving force behind it leaves, for one reason or another, they often fall in disrepair and they fall static. Yeah. And so, you know, his last purchase was a 1994 Dodge Viper that he bought brand new. And that was kind of the end cap to it. He passed away shortly thereafter. And he was heavily involved with selling cars and buying new ones and searching for cars. He was, you know, the original, you know, classic car chaser. And that's what he was doing. And it was a passion. And he found signs and automobilia of all kinds of different stuff. The huge library of, you know, different catalogs and magazines and, you know, different books that you just can't find. And he was always in search of that, you know, that new art, new piece that would bring people in or interest people in some form or fashion. And so, but once he died, you lose that and you lose the restoration drive. You lose the person to say it's
the direction goes. I mean, they're all passion projects. Right. I can imagine that.
And he was an engineer by trade. His name was Frank Spain. And he was fascinated by engineering. He was one of the key developers in MCI, the telephone company, and he helped deliver the fiber optics from, you know, cable companies and things like that. So he was a huge technical engineering guy.
And he owned the TV station down
he
there
owned
too,
several,
right?
Or actually.
Okay.
He had television towers all over the country. Yeah. And so, but he, once he passed away, that whole spirit is lost. And so to maintain something like that without being able to bring in fresh inventory or fresh, you know,
perspective.
Just
yeah.
perspective.
And getting new blood, you know, we found in, just to step off for a second, kind of a smaller scale, different model out at in Collierville.
Art and Speed.
Kevin, I think, was in big tech as well.
Yeah.
And those guys are really great managers and they see big projects. And what I've seen in his business and what they're doing out there is a lot of the same. You know, he brought Justin in, and it's like you've got to keep someone fresh on the payroll that's got new eyes, and it complements your personality.
And with any business like that, the driver of that business has that perspective, the long shot. And he can't always verbalize that to the staff to the point where somebody can pick up the torch. Mm-hmm. And in this situation, his number two guy was in his 80s and was really done with the whole business in general. So once Frank passed, that gentleman stepped away as well. So then it becomes this free for all, and people take advantage of widows. And there was a lot of situations that were causing her grief and stress to where she felt like she couldn't leave. So she turned to me and she said, "Let's sell it." And so that opened the door for us to be able to. I quit my job at the insurance company, went to work for her full time with the goal that I'm here to prepare everything for sale, to hold one big auction, no reserve. Which means there is no minimum price on anything sold.
Wow.
And we will sell everything. And at the end of the day, we will clean sweep it, literally cleaned and swept the floors, and it's empty.
And it was empty. Yeah.
And so Wayne and I, we interviewed three auction houses, and we ended up settling with Bottoms. We felt like they had the most knowledge and most passion for the early stuff. And what Frank had done with his collection is he was interested in the development of the automobile from the very beginning. Mm-hmm. So he had a model of the 1889, or I think it was 18, I can't remember now.
Yeah.
Benz, which was a replica. There's only two in existence. And then we had an 1899 Knox, which was an all original example of an 1899 vehicle. Mm-hmm. And so it started there and went and progressed through time, with each decade represented in a car. And so with the early stuff, I felt like that was the hardest to sell, and that was the most important to get right.
Yeah.
The later stuff, as you get into the Duesenbergs and then the 1940s and on.
Well, people connect with that.
There's a lot of opportunity to capitalize on that, right, regardless of the auction house that you choose. Right. The early stuff was the most important, and to make sure that the documentation was correct, the historical research was done properly. And we had two guys, Rupert Banner and Evan Ide. Evan is a normal feature on Wayne's show.
Yeah,
he's cool, a madman, and he
kind of reminds me of like Steve Mignante on the Meekum auctions.
He's a freak of nature.
Or the Barrett Jackson stuff.
He literally wrote the book on Packards. When people research Packards, it's his book that they go to.
Yeah.
And Evan is a really quirky, weird vegetarian. And I love him to death. He's
great. Weird because he's weird, not because he's vegetarian.
That's right. Well, I don't know. I give him grief on both sides. But Evan was phenomenal with really pulling together a lot of the details that we just didn't have, and helped me get started quite a few cars in that early era, which made a big difference in the sales.
Yeah.
So
that's got to be like a really niche market.
I mean,
there's probably besides a Sheik in Abu Dhabi, who's collecting an 1899?
Shockingly enough, a lot of people do.
Really?
There's a huge passion for this. We're always curious about the next generation and where will they find the interest. And the truth of the matter is, if you're around it and you see how simple they are and how much fun they are to play with. Look, we're not doing 0 to 60 in any time frame. But
you've never done 60 either.
This was, but you're looking at, I think that just the novelty of it, even more, that might not be the right word. The novelty, sure. But I think just to be impressed as people, as engineers, from an engineer standpoint, we were competing against a horse who had to drink water and had to sleep.
Mm-hmm.
We to get down the road in a straight line and not die was like really cool in 1899.
These are time machines. And I think, the one thing that all of us could agree on, all car guys, any historian, you get excited about, the story that the car has had and the story that the car will continue to have with you. And what is your mark on it? And then you move it on to the next guy. And that's right.
Just
that's
a caretaker.
All we are. That's all we are with these classics. Yeah. The idea is that we keep them on the road.
You're custodians to history in that
that's
sense.
Right. Yeah. And sometimes it may just be the stupid chassis that's alive, but it's there.
In part.
Yeah. And there's a thing to that. But with the early stuff, look, it's not for everybody. People look at brass cars and they go, I don't get it. But if you get an opportunity to spend any time around it, and most of us got our passion for, or our memories from a lot of cars through our parents, through our dads, through our moms, you know, through our grandparents, and you know, a true car guy knows what his grandparents drove, right, or knows what his dad drove, you know, and so it's the same thing. If their dad was really interested in these early brass cars, there's some element of that that sticks with the kids. And so, you know, these cars have been around for 100 years, and that doesn't mean that it would be stupid of us to think that they would just die off now because generation, you know,
yeah. Well, the rarity doesn't negate the passion. It doesn't.
So. And there's a, you know, there's such an emotional attachment that people put onto cars.
Yeah, I was gonna say,
you know, I mean, it's no accident that they have a look of a face. That's not an accident.
Right. Or that they name them.
That they name them. Like, yeah. You know, these things are, it's a big thing.
Or that people refuse to work on them unless they're named.
That's right. Weirdos, those guys.
But good host though. Good host.
Yeah. But so, you know, I think the early cars will always have a place. Their values will shock you when you find out what some of this stuff goes for. I mean, I work for an international auction house, the oldest auction house in existence. We started in 1793 and we have been continuously operated ever since.
That's crazy.
And in that, I come across a lot of old cars.
I bet.
And you know, when you see an old Bugatti, an old Mercer, or a Simplex, we sold a Simplex for $4.5 million. And these cars are...
I don't even think I know what a Simplex looks like.
These were the hot rods of the early teens. And they are truly hot rods. Yeah. They have cutouts that were factory built.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I mean, these things are loud. They sound like tractors. They will fly, believe it or not. And being that they don't have doors or windshields or roofs, it feels like you're
faster. It kind of sounds like Matt at the mile.
It will scare you at times.
Yeah. I think he was scared the whole time. Yeah. He had a blowout like the next day. He shouldn't have been on that track.
I was in a 1915 Mercer just recently, and I'll tell you, I scared myself in the thing.
Yeah.
They're exciting and they're fun to drive, and they're quirky and weird, and so are the rest of this crap we drive.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it just is.
Well, life expectancy back then, and what was it, like 35? Like,
yeah. Right?
Oh, trust me. The guy, you got a 35-year-old behind the wheel of a 35-mile-per-hour vehicle. He's ready to go.
Yeah. And there was no driver's licenses. So 12-year-olds were driving these things. I mean, it was crazy.
They had to go get the ice block.
That's right. You know?
They just had to have a person walking out in front with a flag, right?
Yeah, like lighting tech.
Yeah.
Like where that's come. The gaslight. You're lighting a candle, putting a glass case over it, and going down the road in the reflect. Can you imagine driving at night?
Yeah.
Just like on a road that didn't really exist.
Well, here's the part that usually baffles people is that, you know, all these lantern looking things on the front of these cars, they detach, and they detach really easily with a screw.
Yeah.
And the reason is they didn't have electricity. So they used that to walk themselves up to the house.
Well, yeah. I mean, no lit driveway.
That's these were really a great little selling feature.
Yeah.
But the, you know, the real special thing out of that collection was the Tucker. It was the most valuable, of course, had a great story, had great history. It was one of the 7 cars used at Indianapolis to do the speed trials. It was number 1026, if I remember. 1027 was the one that they rolled over and then drove again.
And that was the one you guys had?
So we had 1026. This car was never rolled, before. Thankfully.
Yeah. You could see those steel frame shots of the guys being ejected.
Yeah.
And mud. They were on dirt, right? They were dirt.
No, tracks, this was a concrete track.
What was the track that with the wood tracks? You remember when?
No, those are board tracks. Yeah,
Motorcycle racing.
That's a whole.
I thought they did have cars on.
They had car deck tracks.
About scary. Jeez.
I mean, you're already in a death trap, and then you're like, let's put some floors that don't stay together.
No seatbelts. Let's crank it up.
You guys like basketball? It's kind of like that.
It's kind of like that.
Yeah.
The Tucker was the second highest brought for a Tucker, and the car didn't run. There was a lot of,
wasn't there an extra motor with it?
Who, do you remember who actually walked away with that?
Yeah. So that went to the Maine Museum up in Maine. Mm-hmm. It is there. They've got it running now.
Cool.
There was a whole huge discussion about, do we get it running? Do we not? I won the argument because I kept saying like,
it's meant to run. It's a car.
Of course. Yes. However, if you break it,
That's the last one.
Go find another helicopter engine from 1949. Like, it's not happening.
There were gyroscopes back then.
Look, I mean, this thing is crazy. That was the biggest seller. It sold for $1.8 million-ish.
Mm.
Drop
in the bucket. I'll take 2.
Yeah, you know, we all will. Through that process, through getting everything organized, and I had to get something to the tune of, I think it was 100 and 135 titles for these cars because they didn't have titles. When getting titles for early 1900 cars is challenging. Getting one for an 1899, that's a whole other thing.
Yeah, I was gonna say, like, you kind of went right to the auction, but you did a ton.
It was a lot of work.
Order to find, because he bought things, didn't have titles, didn't have documentation on some of that kind of stuff, and you actually. And what was it, a year and a half, two years that you worked down there?
It was about 18 months.
Getting everything together.
And it's an hour and a half away from my house. So I was working about 16-hour days. My wife still reminds me of that, how much I missed. Our auction was actually the day of my daughter's birthday. So, like, it was just every way I could screw
this
thing
up. It's my job, honey. Yeah, I gotta go
work.
Bring your daughter to work.
It was the greatest job ever to be able to go in, be completely left alone. And all you have to do is, you know, just dig through stuff about cars. It was great. I had so much fun.
Yeah.
And I got to yell at people, and I got to, you know, fight with people that said that I donated a car 25 years ago, but I just really meant to put it on loan. I'd like it back. You know, it was great.
That sounds fun. Awesome.
And look, they won some of those arguments. I gave back two cars. The first one I gave back was a guy that had built it with his father and had no way to keep it when they donated it to the museum.
Loaned it.
Yeah. So I mean, he did take taxes and all that kind of stuff. But in the process of, you know, the heartstrings were torn. It was not a very expensive car, but I was trying not to stand on my heels on everything. And I said,
well, you don't want to set a precedent.
So I was very friendly. I told the guy, I said, look, we've talked about it. We decided Jane really was the one that said, yes, your car's yours. And he says, oh man, that's so awesome. I would like to put it in the auction.
Oh my God.
And I went, are you serious?
I thought it was so sentimental. You had to have it. Like, what's your dad have to say about it?
He's like, well, what would it cost me to put it in the auction? I said, I'll tell you what. I said, you can't put it in the auction. It's outside right now, and there's a thunderstorm on the way. Come get it.
Yeah.
He's like, I don't know how to do that. And I was like, that's your problem.
That's your car.
It was crazy.
The audacity.
I never heard that story
before. We had people that were, you know, I probably shouldn't say this one, but I don't care. So the
statute of limitations.
That's right.
I don't know if that's true.
So the Tupelo Elvis Presley Birthplace Museum had a Plymouth that was similar to the one that Elvis his parents had owned. And it sits out there under a shed and it's rotting away. And a gentleman came to me, he's a local businessman, came to me and he goes, so, you know, that Plymouth that we got over there at the museum, I just want you to know, like, that doesn't go with the auction. And I was like, actually,
it's already there,
pal. I have the title. Like, it's planned to go. And he goes, no, we have a contract. And I was like, yes, I read your contract. It says that for $1 a year, you get to keep the car.
He hasn't paid the dollar.
I said, can you show me a receipt where you've paid $1 a year? And he was a jerk when we started this conversation. I left out a few things, but he was a jerk when they started this conversation. So I'm not normally just a complete asshat, but I was in this moment. Let me say that.
Yeah, you got it.
So he comes back to me and he says, well, here's, and he throws a $20 bill down. And I was like, if you think that's how contracts work, you've missed something. I said, that's not how it works. You're in breach of contract. Car's going for sale. Or you can buy it for what?
Put that 20 towards the purchase price.
I said, or you can, you know, you're welcome to bid. Or I'll tell you what, if you want to pay me what Frank paid for it back when we bought it, then you can have it back. It's $10,000. Car was worth about $800. He wrote me a check for $10,000. I gave it to the museum. There it was.
Dang, wow. Really?
Wow. Fair square deal.
So after about 6 months of all this chaos that was going on in Tupelo, Bonham said, look, you know, we're supposed to be sending you somebody to come help you with titles and this and that. And I said, we're doing it all. It's I got it covered. And they said, well, what are you going to do after this? I was like, well, I'm selling myself out of a job. So do you have an application I can fill out? And that's how I got the job. So
I've been working ever since.
I've been fired twice, but I've been working ever since. they can't get enough of me. I can't stop insulting.
Well, the way you contract negotiate, I have no doubt you got it. Your job. Yeah. It says right here that you said you'd have me on retainer.
That's right. We have a lot of fun. I'm the lead bid spotter in the room. So if you ever watch them on TV, you'll hear them calling my name. It sounds like I'm buying every car in the place. But we have a lot of fun, and it's really just to say that I, you know.
So you're like out there, one of them guys.
You're amongst the, yeah, you're one of the people.
Bottoms doesn't really do that.
I don't have a whistle. Yeah. I don't raise a handkerchief like they do at Barrett Jackson, you know. Yeah.
What's your shtick, man?
I don't really have
one. Perfectly coiffed hair is not working for you.
I'm really good at yelling out numbers, and that's what I do. So we have a lot of fun. I have had such an experience, you know. I was a fan of this.
Yeah,
you know, I'm just like everybody else. I sat and watched Barrett.
I was completely enamored by the whole process. Like, and the people were like, everyone has their own reasons for watching.
Yep.
Like some of them are like, I can't believe someone would pay that much, and the other ones are like, I didn't even know that was a real car that existed.
That's right.
And then everyone else is just like,
well, and we have
that's not worth it.
We have people that will go through the effort and the money to go out to these auctions, and they sit there with a notebook and they write down what they think the car's worth. And then they write down what the car sold for.
Like a whole game.
And it's a whole thing.
That's so cool.
And there's a whole group of people that do this. And look, you know, when
they don't buy, they just do that.
They just do that.
You know, I'm not going to call Mattel, but after this, we're going to sit down and come up with a board game.
Somebody should.
Meekum just heard that. And they're like, the bottom guy told us how to do it.
Yeah. I get to go to a lot of these auctions, and I get to, you know, all these people that I saw on TV or that I always thought, you know, oh my God, like, how do you even get to meet Chip Foose? The answer is you go to a freaking auction.
Yeah.
He's there.
They're all in the same room.
And the circle is the car world is really, really small as long as you get on an airplane. I mean, that's what it is. It's expensive to go to some of these locations because the locations themselves are just expensive.
Yeah.
But the ability to go into an auction and sit down in a seat and experience that is something that you can do it on a budget. And people should, because it is something that a lot of people I run into are like, you know, it's on my bucket list. And it's like, don't make it on your butt. Just do it.
Yeah.
Because Meekum and Barrett Jackson, they're everywhere. I mean, you know, they're within driving distance of everybody because they have so many.
Yeah. So, with your auction house, what's like the minimum to get in to sell a car?
To sell a car. So all the auction houses have kind of stuck together in the sense that the fees are all about the same. So nobody has decided to go, you know,
percentage eBay. They haven't got eBay.
No, they haven't got eBay. So it's 10% is the standard fee.
Yeah.
That does change based on two factors. One, the value of your car. If you bring me, we have a car that's estimated between $40 and $50 million. If you bring me a car like that, you have a lot more leverage to negotiate. At the same time, that's a really difficult car to sell.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's a fine line we walk there with getting the business and getting business that we can actually achieve, because the auction house doesn't make any money unless you sell it.
Right.
You know, every auction house will charge you a $1,500 lot fee, most likely.
Just for showcasing the car prior to.
And then they'll charge a photography fee. So, you know, Sean has to be paid to go out and spend 4 hours with me in the middle of the heat. And come up with a magical picture that, you know, I will broadcast everywhere.
So you get $1,400 and he gets $100.
Yeah, exactly.
More like $50.
All right.
We're not going to talk about that
part. I'm starting to see why he's sitting on his cooler, not in a wheelchair.
My time is valuable and I'm a really good assistant.
Yeah.
But you know, there's those basic car costs. The other factor is transportation. So to get your car from point A to point B, wherever that is expensive. And the you know, fuel costs are always a factor. And right before we were here, I just loaded up a car to send out to California. And it's $3,000. And it's $3,000 each way. So
if it doesn't go, it's $3,000.
It comes back
in. And the house eats that?
No.
On the return trip?
The seller pays that. So,
so you're good.
But it's an expensive venture for someone to sell. However, when you go to the prime location where you have the richest, most
it's California, right?
Well, it's not just California. We have helicopter parking at that sale.
The Catalina wine mixer.
And so at Quail,
you're going to Quail.
I will have next. Quail is just south of it's on the peninsula of Monterey. It's just south of Pebble Beach, about 10 minutes away, 15 minutes depending on traffic. But it's a beautiful location. It's right there on the coast, and that is not for the faint of heart.
No, like, so how exclusive is Quail to get, like, just to go, like, do your spectator? You are a buyer if you're at Quail.
Yeah, to get into this show for most individuals, it's going to cost you $100. You buy a catalog, and the catalog gets you and a guest entry for the catalog price.
Can you bid, or you have to be vetted to bid at
You have to be vetted to bid, and there are levels to that. So anything north of, I think it's $500,000, you have a more in-depth. Usually they'll ask for a bank letter,
credit process or whatever.
Well, and what they'll do, all the auction houses will kind of do the same thing. They'll either have you pre-approved for credit, knowing the limits, or they will ask for a bank letter, which states that my client is capable of purchasing anything within this specter, you know, this, you know, 100,000, you know, to capped at 500,000. And then there's the more in-depth one, which is a purple paddle.
Blood diamonds.
And that's blood diamonds. And that allows you to purchase virtually anything.
Yeah.
And then with this particular auction, I think we're going to have one more category because
the ceiling is so high on
the ceiling's pretty high.
Okay.
So if this car sells and sells where we think it will sell, it will be the most expensive car, most expensive Ferrari to ever sell, which Ferrari is currently the second position in the most expensive car ever.
Ever. Yeah.
Mercedes threw it all out of whack last year with RM. They sold a Mercedes SLR that was one of two production cars. That was actually just a prototype. It was a one-off thing.
Mercedes.
Oh, probably. Yeah. It came out of Mercedes actual collection.
It was their personal car.
Mercedes shadow bought it or whatever. Proxy bought it.
Really, that was really interesting to me that they did that.
It was an invite only auction.
Yeah. So that sounds like the car auction version of a Panama pump where you're kind of feeding your own thing to kind of hype your own stuff. Yeah. You don't have to answer that.
I don't know. Like
big car is not coming after me in this little Airstream. So
I know a lot of big players that were not invited.
Yeah.
And I mean, you know, to be a big player, to be a player in that room, you were a billionaire. Right. There was a room full of people that had lots and lots of commas in their wealth.
Yeah.
Jeff Bezos was probably like, I'll take two.
Yeah. He wasn't invited.
I don't know why not. This guy's going to space with a dick rocket.
but he's not buying a Mercedes, apparently, what the case was.
Right.
But that one sold for $155 million.
Yeah.
So before that, it was, I think, 52 was, I think, the record. The car we have offered is one of six. It was one of the cars that was the story was told in Ford versus Ferrari. It's called a 67 Ferrari 412P, also known as a P4. Just an absolutely beautiful car. Mm-hmm. And the estimate is between $40 and $50 million, I think.
Is it a race car?
Is that
it was a race car. Yes, it is a race car. It is street legal.
Was Bugatti driving that car in the story in the Ford versus Ferrari? Like how had to accuracy on the story?
I don't know that this car wasn't replicated to that extent.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Blew the engine in the last drama. Yeah. I mean, TV.
I didn't read that much of the description yet. So I'll do that on the
plane. Your auction house sounds swell.
So this is the one that I didn't get to take pictures of.
You did not get to take pictures.
You probably weren't allowed to look at it. You're just a mere mortal.
But they won't let me sit in that one. So, you know. nor do I really want to.
No.
One of the craziest stats, but you know, people are like, oh my God, you get to drive these cars. Like, yes,
that's nerve wracking.
Get to drive them, and it's terrifying.
Yeah,
yeah. Because what you do too, for the most part, you're driving it to load it on a trailer or something. You're not going out and just enjoying it.
You're rarely going out to just enjoy it. You know, every once in a while, Sean will pick a place like Shelby Forest, where it's 60 miles round trip. I don't know why that was the case. But
I was helping my brother out.
Blind turns everywhere.
Yeah,
rednecks are drinking and driving. No problem.
Right after a huge thunderstorm. Right after a huge storm happened. Yeah, we're going through Shelby Forest, man. And I was thinking, there's a spot right inside the thing, whatever. Well, we get there and there's guys clearing trees, clearing shrubs and all that stuff where I was wanting to shoot it. So I was like, oh, okay, there's another spot around the corner. Well, man, Shelby Forest is a lot bigger than you think it is.
I grew up out there.
Yeah, it's like 6 miles over to like where the lake and stuff is, but it's all like this.
Dead man curves.
Yeah, it's all these sticks and everything.
When you get closer towards the bluff, that thing just drops.
I'm just wondering at that point, like, is Sean setting me up for something?
Yeah, right.
Am I leaving here?
The A-team van pulled up and just clubbed you.
I heard a banjo. It was crazy.
Because, the other thing was they just... My thought was they just repaved out there. It's all
that was great,
beautiful. Yeah,
that was great,
like awesome. But some trees had fallen across, and so there were a couple places where it was like all junk. I was like, oh my God, I can't believe I just did this to him in this car.
Well, the park ranger pulls up as we're shooting, and
that's pretty funny.
I walk over and I'm like, hey, how's it going?
What did he say? Are you joking?
He looks at me and goes, what are you guys doing? I was like, well, we're shooting photographs of the cars.
Taking sexy pictures. Yeah. What are you doing?
And he says, he goes, well, did y'all open it up on those roads? Were y'all driving too fast? And I was like, no, sir. No, we were bad. And he goes, do you want to?
Oh, my God.
Yes.
No, very I'm good. So. Thanks.
I need to make friends with them, actually, so I can go out there in the fair lane, rip through there.
But I remember the first time I went out to Monterey, and I had a client that asked me, he said, look, I can't be out there, but I need you to, sort out a car for me. He's English. And I'm like, okay, what does sort out mean?
He goes, run it through the numbers.
Look, American, I want you to actually get out and drive the car. Yeah. And I was like, okay, which car is it you're looking at? He says, the Ferrari F40. So I'm like, man, great. I'm so excited. And I am. I was so excited at the same time.
Yeah.
There are many versions of Sean out there by the thousands, and they sit
with their phones.
They're at the corners, and they all have fancy cameras. They have multiple cameras. They're out there taking selfies and whatever the hell they do with these photos. I don't know. There's just bunches of them. It's like paparazzi everywhere.
Yeah.
They jump out in the middle of the road and taking pictures of this Ferrari coming up, and I'm sitting here terrified.
Yeah.
And so I've got to sort it out. And so I take it up and, he wants me to go through all the gears, which, in a Ferrari F40, what you don't know is that you have to get up to speed to do that. They don't just do that in, casual driving. So, I'm out to driving this car and it's got hardly any miles on it. I'm like, am I really supposed to be doing that? And luckily the guy bought the car. So I felt like, at least I was justified in what I did.
And now the punchline, what'd you do? and does your employer need to know that?
That's right. But it is great fun. And it is great responsibility. And, I always tell people that, you have to be a grown up when you drive these cars.
Because,
they were posters for me as a kid. And I dreamed about taking them through McDonald's and showing off all my high school friends. And that's not really what we get to do with them.
Well, that's what they're selling with those cars.
Yeah.
The supercars are a dream car.
Oh, sure.
The fact that you even get to see one in person, snaps people's necks off, and you get to do that every day.
Yes. And I try really, really hard. My wife and I, my wife is the one who tries to keep me grounded anyway. And she's like, you used to watch these shows and now you're on some of them. Like, you have to remember that you used to get excited when you saw anything old with flaking paint. Like you have to still appreciate that. I was like, okay, that's a good reminder because, I do pass by stuff and go, that one's the paint, not good. Door gaps don't match and that's not a real engine and blah, blah, blah. I saw a Cobra one day. I'm like, it's not a real one. And she's like, really? Like, son, really? Like, really? I used to get excited about stuff like that. So I'm trying to really work on really
humble, getting back to the humble,
pulling roots myself backwards and saying, this is really an incredible opportunity.
Yeah.
And it is great fun. I mean, I never got invited to come talk to you guys when I was working, at the insurance company or selling payroll.
We didn't want you.
I don't know why. Like, I was
well, insurance was a is a guy. Scam,
Oh, you said.
Oh, look at that.
I think I still have a license, but whatever.
I hate them till I need them. You know that.
Right.
But what the things that you get to do, certainly on the grand scale, you get to go to all the fancy parties, you get to do all the fancy travel and all this kind of stuff. But you also get to meet people. And that is by far my absolute favorite part of this is that, I get to meet people of all walks of life. And being in Memphis, I live here. I live in Germantown. I try to be approachable. I'm usually approachable. I go to as many car shows as I can. It's never enough. But the truth of the matter is I love to meet people. I love to hear the stories about their cars. They're so passionate. And it doesn't matter if it's, a $50 million Ferrari or if it's, excuse me. I was at a show. I was in, West Palm Beach, Florida. And this teenager pulls in with a Gremlin. And I thought, that's the way you start. Because this kid was mobbed by these people. Mm. And it was because everybody knew what the hell it was.
Yeah.
They all remembered it. And you never see them. And this car was pristine. And I love that. And, he was like, it was my grandmother's car. She sold Avon out of the back of it.
Oh,
like,
wow.
It was the whole
color was it?
It was exactly what you would expect. Pea green.
There it is.
Pea green interior. And it was immaculate. She had plastic coverings on the seat that he left there.
Factory, probably.
So yeah, I'm sure it was.
Nice.
But it was, you know, it's. I love to meet the people. I love to meet the stories. Mm. And you get to find crazy stuff. You know, I've found some holy grail stuff. And people throw that name. You know, really, it's the gas mic you guys throw it around. But it's true. They exist. Like, there are these crazy situations where, I was just telling you. Now I'm gonna unveil some of what I was telling you. I won't say who it is, but there is a client that I have that's been a great friend of mine, and he introduced me to his Pride and Joy collection. Now, he has an enormous collection of cars. He's not here local, but he has an enormous collection of cars. And he says, "I've got something you haven't seen, I'm sure." And I was like, "Okay, great. Well, I love to find stuff I haven't seen before." So he takes me out to the middle of a field where there's a building. He opens the door and there's engines and there's you know, the old wooden pallets that are stacked up and you can't get in. And I'm like, what the hell? And he goes, you have to climb over that one. Be careful because it might fall and there's a step on the other side. Okay. And I'm like, oh, this is a little weird. But, you know, I don't have the filter to say this is too scary. I can talk about how I met Greg Duncan once. But so I climb over and I get in here and he flips a light switch, and in the back of the room is in Gulf livery, a 1966 Ford GT40.
Oh,
it's
wow.
On jack stands with the doors open.
Wow.
And I called back over to him and I said,
Le Mans car?
No. Oh. I called back over to him and I said, how long have you had this? And he goes, Dad bought it in 67 or 68.
Jeez.
And I'm like, that's not possible. And so I walk over and I look, and this thing is in pristine condition. It's an air conditioned, heated garage, out in the middle of a field in nowhere. And he says, yeah, Dad got it delivered and got in it, drove it here, opened the doors, put it on jack stands, and that's where it sits. It has 84 miles on it, and that's what it's got.
Wow.
And I'm like, this is amazing. And he's like, what's it worth? And I'm like, look, there's
priceless.
No, there's no such thing.
You can't say priceless.
Like, it's not priceless. It's got a number to it. Don't know what it is.
Yeah.
And it's virtually impossible to say what it is because there's not another one to compare it to.
And it's as much as anyone's willing to pay.
It's as much as anyone's willing to pay. Yeah. And
all you need is two.
That's right. You need two. Actually, sometimes you just need one.
Yeah.
Auction houses have that. People think there's something really awful about what's called, you know, chandelier bidding or fake bidding or all that kind of stuff. But the truth is that the auction house, specifically the auctioneer, has complete control over the sale. So he is informed of what the seller is willing to sell the car for. At that point, he represents the seller against the audience and bidders to say, I will bid on this on the behalf. They will say a disclaimer at the beginning. He is freely welcome to bid on behalf of the seller to move the number forward to a sellable number. The room sometimes knows, sometimes they don't. It's an ugly thing sometimes when it happens. It happened with a Porsche a couple of years ago in Monterey, the first Porsche ever sold. And there was a confusion with the auctioneer's accent and the car. So at the time, the record was $48 million paid for a Ferrari GTO. And this Porsche was a very special car. It was requested to be built by no other than Adolf Hitler.
Oh,
and it was known as the Hitler car. And the car goes up for sale and they open the bidding at $30 million, it sounds like. He goes 30, he goes 40, and he goes 50. When he hits 50, I pull my phone out and I'm filming.
Yeah.
I had some celebrities standing next to me. Because
that was going
to
be like the new record.
Look, this is blown past the record all of a sudden by millions of dollars. And so I had some celebrity friends celebrities were standing around me in the back of this room, and this room is packed. Everybody's got their phone up in the air, and it's $50 million, $60 million, $70 million. The room goes nuts. Well, he looks up and he sees that because it's on a big giant screen, $70 million. And he goes, no, 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 no. That's my Danish accent. It's actually $17 million. And so, and it's still to this day. I know him very well.
I don't understand. So somebody was willing to pay $70 million?
No.
I'm a little confused at what you're telling me.
$17 million.
He started with $13 million.
Okay.
It sounded like he started with 30.
30.
And so he says 13, 14, 15, 16, and he gets to 17. And the clerk, there's a lady sitting next to him, and she's typing in what he's saying. And she's not paying attention to the audience. She doesn't know where the bid's coming from. She's just doing what she's told.
Just a stenographer.
She's just sitting and typing in the numbers. And his accent was so bad that you just couldn't make it out. And so it sounded to everyone in the room, and it's, you know, there's a lot of commotion once you hit.
Sure. Is she typing in the correct number or the 70?
Wrong number. Yeah. So the audience sees 30, 40.
Well, what's crazy to me is
he never looked at the screen.
Well, not that he didn't look at the screen. That screen is popping up and people are still bidding.
There's no bidding.
There's no bidding.
So there's no bidding.
Okay. That's where I was like, dude, get as much as you can get.
So the most likely the reserve on that car was probably $25 million. Yeah. So he's bidding on behalf of the seller. So he's running the number up to a point where the next bid gets us within a window that we can, you know, have a conversation with the seller saying, hey, dude, like, we've got real numbers on this. It's time to sell. You know, let it go and see if we get more. And that's the you know, whenever you see, you know, Frank Meekham standing in the middle of the circle at the front, he's hammering the seller. And that's why the brilliant thing, here's some advice, folks.
Okay.
I don't work for Meekham. Here's your advice. If you ever sell a car at Meekham, go to the bathroom when they're looking for you. They're looking for you three cars ahead. They want to know where you are. They want you in the circle so that Frank can work your numbers down. And the truth of the matter is, if you just don't show up to the circle, chances are more than likely you're going to magically get the number you're looking for.
Yeah.
Because the auction house has the ability to wiggle. So they're making 12% up to the first $250,000 bid on a car. After $250,000, your percentage drops down to 10% as a buyer. So the buyer is going to pay 12% on the first $250,000, 10% thereafter. So they have this allotment of money that as the bidding goes on and they have live money in the room, they have this amount they can play with. So as they're trying to make, because the auction house doesn't get paid unless we sell the car. So if you've got a reserve on the car and they're trying to make the deal happen and it's exciting and we do it and there's real passion and there's real feelings and sometimes it's horrible situations where dad died and this is what he wanted us to do as a family. And we had that situation recently and your job is to stand there and make the deal happen.
Yeah.
And so sometimes it's gut wrenching, but the truth is that, you know, when you have live money, you jump on it and you try not to lose it because after an auction, it's much harder. That whole bid goes on thing is a tough deal because the seller's standing on a number and the buyer's standing on a number. And a lot of times it doesn't work.
And nobody wins.
Yep. So the auction house, a lot of times will cut their skin in the game to make that deal happen. And that's what you effectively want as a buyer or seller. It's really tough to get into there and know how that works.
But you see that in the real estate market at closing.
Yes.
So your real estate agents are willing to come up by percentage. It's essentially the same thing.
Money in the hand.
We worked really hard on this deal. Let's not let it fall apart over $100,000.
That's right. That's a lot of money.
Well, to some people, not to your friends.
Well, you know, it's true. It's really true.
Like, yeah,
I live in Germantown too.
It's such an exciting game, and it happens so quickly. Cars are on the block typically 90 seconds. From the intro to the hammer, it's usually 90 seconds. And there's things called short hammer. You see that at certain situations and Barrett Jackson, but the auctioneer has the ability to do whatever he wants. That's not in the contract. You don't have, you know, clock to set on and say that, you know, you sold my car, but you sold it in, you know, 62 seconds and, you know, there's probably more money in the room. Well, they've got thousands of cars they're running through over the course of 10 days.
Yeah.
I can promise you, they don't care. Like, they're moving them.
I paid for this crap. Give me my time, you know?
It's tough.
You know what gets me? You see rare GT40s and supercars, hypercars, all this cool stuff. What gets me is that Art Deco old and then gigantic. When the Future Liner hit the block.
Oh, yeah.
The story behind the Future Liner.
Oh, sure.
I was complete. That's the atomic era. Like, I was like completely in love with that whole story.
Yeah,
I
bet you were.
And like, I mean, what is your issue with it? Like,
no, I mean, that goes along with some of the things that drive you.
And I mean, that, I mean, yeah, it's I mean, the same obviously, thing. Obviously yeah. We're sitting in the right. Same area.
Yeah, that's what he meant. It's the same thing.
I thought there was like a secret story. Like,
no.
We got something to say.
It's
about
not a
the
deal.
Guy.
I bet you were, guy.
No, but what you see in these things, you know, the Future Liner is a great example of
that was Meekham. You know, was that Meekham that did that? Or Barrett?
I think it was. I think they've both sold.
Yeah, I think so.
Four of them, I think.
Yeah.
I just saw one in Indiana at the Duesenberg Museum.
They are just so amazing.
Yeah. Kindig built one. I think it was at Barrett.
I think you're right.
Yeah.
And it was an original. He didn't repop that. That was he got the original bones and the serial number. And
right. I don't think
how many of them existed?
I think there were five.
And they were promo for GM. What did they show? They were showing a new propulsion system. What was the big thing on?
It was everything.
It was the fact that you know, progress for America.
And they were showcasing
the move forward. What it will look like in the next decade and whatever. And you know, we're often wrong about that, by the way.
Of course.
But the fact that, you know, and I still say this, and I'm really disappointed that Dodge is pulling the plug on some of their muscle cars, because, you know, what I've always found fascinating, and it goes from very early cars to now, is that somewhere at some point, designers sat in a room with marketing people and executives, and they said, we want to build a pink muscle car.
Yeah.
And they said, okay, let's do it. Let's make
my whole thing is what gets lost in translation. Cause when you see the prototype and everyone gets excited about the prototype.
Yeah.
And then the old heads that know are like, it'll never make it.
Yeah.
If they put that on the
floor, like that.
Well, even, let's just say if they did, like, I try and understand why an industry would tease something like that, and the end product looks like Mr. Potato Head with all the parts put on it wrong. There's so many factors. I saw there was a really great documentary about the Mustang in 2016.
Yeah.
Did you guys watch it?
I caught part of that one.
So the interesting thing about Ford, and I can speak from an educated,
it's a documentary stand, about the
new 2016. The 2016 was a whole revamp.
Okay. Yeah.
And I appreciated the access that documentary was giving the makers of that to Ford and to the process.
Yeah.
Because, like, we're looking at what just hit now. That was in the works in 2016. Like, sure, it's just like the military. Like, they're working on stuff we have no idea that's happening.
Well, you know, what always happens, and probably has always happened, is that, you know, there are great designers, there are great engineers, and then there are really, really great lawyers.
Yeah.
And that's the part that screws everything up. It's really those guys.
So there was this interesting, to get to my point, and it's a little touchback on the Blue Oval City that's coming with all the E stuff. And that's a hot button. We'll step off that. But the 2016, if you ever get a chance, I don't remember what it was called. It was something about the pony car or something. The whole deal almost got cut loose and back to formula because they outsourced the factory somewhere in the Orient or in Philippines or something. Mm-hmm. The company, they were stalling. And they couldn't get like a component. So Ford, being Ford, was like, what's the problem? They bought the factory, basically bought the whole town and gave everyone a job so that they could keep that Mustang on track. And now there is a Ford plant in that part of the world because of that. Yeah. And that's not the first time big Ford has done that.
I was going to say,
that's
Ford did that with
the Brazilian
rubber tree factory.
Rubber tree factory. We'll move earth and heaven to make a car happen if we're that big. Yeah. I mean, somebody's vision was like, we're upset over, you know, I think it was a dash component, and the factory couldn't keep up with the injection molding. And they were like, we're buying the factory. We're sending our best guys down there and get this Mustang back on track. And I see that there's factors like that, but like people that are just like, I didn't like the way it looked. I'm like, that's just you, man. That's like the rest of us wanted to see that.
And you know, it's that blinders on. I see the point I want to get to. It's all of these, you know, specialty wired people that are drivers in these industries that say, you know, I'm fascinated by the fact that they get any of it accomplished. Yeah. You know, I think that was one of the downsides to Tucker, is that he was doing everything that was in the stupid prototype, essentially. And it caused so much drama among his competitors, and he didn't have the cash to be able to fight them. And that's what gets in the way of innovation.
Yeah.
Dodge brothers had the same deal.
It's always about money.
We always ask the guys, and we should have, we're doing you a disservice because we jumped in with both feet.
Great.
Favorite car growing up?
Oh my God.
Not just a poster. Like, I'm like, I'm going to get that attainable car.
Poster is Lamborghini with your name on the license plate.
And then we're going to go with what you actually started off with, hot rod.
Oh my God. It's such so embarrassing. Okay.
No, so, Sean's got the worst one, but continue.
So, my dream was to have my dad's old car.
Oh, obviously.
That was it. And I'm still searching for it.
66 Mustang.
65 Mustang.
65.
It was, you mean his car, not just
I found plenty of them that'll like it. I want his. Hey,
we had the same conversation in the backyard about that Impala.
Yeah.
Oh, the pain.
It's
an heirloom, man.
And there's something, I don't know. It's been rebuilt once. We had eyes on it at one point. It ended up at my uncle's house at one point. And he got into some financial trouble and sold it to his brother, who then sold it to somebody.
Somebody.
And I've got an insurance card with a VIN number on it. So
you got a VIN number and you can't find it?
Yeah. So I'm afraid something awful happened. I think I found it at one point, and the guy on the phone wasn't very friendly, so I don't know.
Last registered, do you know?
Yeah, last registered in Slidell, Louisiana.
Year.
It was probably... Oh, you're going to make me a lie.
Heading down toward the Gulf.
It would have been 92, 93, something like that.
Wow. A lot of gators down in that country.
There's a lot of salt air down there.
And what I ended up with, this is embarrassing, 1981 Ford F-100 pickup truck that was my uncle's. It was his work truck. My dad paid $1,000, had a 3-speed on the column, and no engine, no seats, 3 wheels. And so it took me 2 summers. I put a 351 Windsor in it, lowered it about 3 inches, and cut out the fender wells.
Bigger tire.
No exhaust. Mom was furious the first time I started it up. She had no idea. She thought I was just tinkering in the garage. And I rolled this thing out, and she was like, absolutely not. You just knocked every picture frame off the windows. it was a whole thing. So I after my 5th ticket and 3rd accident, it was sold.
Oh.
And God only knows where it is.
Those picture frames were safe.
The neighbors were happy. It was all a thing.
What'd you slime into after that?
After that, it was really boring stuff because, you know, I'm a kid on a budget.
Any Miatas?
No, I had a Dodge Avenger at one point that I hit a cow in.
What year was that?
Let's see, what was that? 1996 Dodge Avenger. How the hell
do you hit a cow? That's awesome, man. Hey, man, they get out.
We got to hear the story about how you hit a cow.
South Louisiana, leaving my girlfriend's house in New Roads along a windy road next to a river. And
you shouldn't call your ex-girlfriend a cow.
You know, we don't speak anymore. My wife will be very happy I say that. So, I'm just late at night driving home, no lights on the streets. And, you know, I'm tootling along to probably ZZ Top. I don't know, whatever. Yeah. AC/DC.
Don't make it cooler than it was, man. Continue.
And two cows step out. I still say it was 2 cows. The farmer says there was 1. I said there was 2. I swerved to miss the first. I missed the first. When I swerved back, I caught the second. A lot of stakes later and a totaled car. Yeah. And, you know.
So any injuries?
The cow was not healthy.
How about you?
No, it's fine.
So my father father hit a cow in a Monte Carlo, broke his leg.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well,
I was much luckier than that. I got stakes.
Yeah.
Nice. You got something out of it. That's pretty good.
And then
pre-tenderized.
Pre-tenderized. Yes, it was.
So. I pay extra for
that. I almost hit a bison in Yellowstone.
Oh my God!
You would have been all over the internet.
You would have been in jail.
Yeah, that's cool. But I was. We were coming back from.
They name those animals out there.
There's, well, yeah, I know, right? They all have names, they track numbers, and whatever. Well, so we were. We had gone to, they call it the Serengeti of Yellowstone. I can't remember what it is, but it's where you can see all sorts of animals and stuff. And we were staying on the other side of the mountain, so. We're coming back from there at dark. So I'm running at dark going back up over the mountain. And man, I come over like it was like a switchback on the mountain coming back around. Come around, and there's the headlights, man, right there. And like up on the mountain, like shouldn't even been there, you know, but here's this stupid bison like, you know, you see his big eyeball staring at you. He's like, oh, you know, I mean, I wasn't.
You're in the fair lane?
No.
Bison was thinking that you shouldn't have been there.
No, yeah.
Just saying.
Yeah, but it was just crazy because, like, you would have expected to see, like, a mountain goat or, you know, bighorn sheep or maybe even elk.
Bear.
But, like, a bison being way up there. It was just really weird
because, like, there was a guardrail.
Yeah, there was a guardrail on one side and cliff or you know, rock on this side. So he was like in this weird spot where you wouldn't expect one to be.
You're lucky he didn't attack your car.
Yeah, I know, right?
Sure.
Yeah, like it was like
scary.
Rental? What were you in?
Yeah, it was a rental.
Oh, that would have been fine
at that time.
You could have done that,
but man, yeah, it was like
you're making decent bucks. You sprung for the mid-size.
You hit one of those, though, man. It's
over, bro.
It's coming through. Yeah.
It's federal offense, man.
Airbag deployment and definitely on YouTube.
I mean, luckily, because it was just after a switchback. I was probably only doing about 35 miles an hour at the time.
Sure.
Like, bah! Yeah.
Like somebody ran over a goose in Germantown and they arrested the guy. Yeah, so I'm just saying.
He had no doubt.
That sounded like malicious intent.
Let me tell you, those Canadian geese are suicidal sometimes. I'm just saying.
They're Canadian, man.
They're Canadian geese. They need to go anyway.
Whoa.
Wow.
Some of them, man, hear something seriously, some of those geese, they're a pain in the butt. Canadian geese.
Who has a whole story? Geese,
right? Well, so my next door neighbor has a lake in his backyard and they come over there and there's like 50, 60 of them, and then they come in my backyard and shit poop all everywhere. Over the place. Yeah, it's horrible. Like, I was going to make a gun just to...
Oh, yeah.
Not a gun to shoot them, just a gun to scare them.
Right.
Bang.
What was our host's name? It's Sean Brereton.
Sean, you have some strange problems, man. He
does. I'll be honest with you, Sean, unless you have a hunting license and they're not in season, that is a state offense.
Yeah, no, I wouldn't.
Your friend that said you could wide open, he'd be all too happy to arrest you.
I wouldn't kill them. I don't really care.
I just want to maim them a little bit.
Right.
Yeah. I just want to
make it where they don't fly so good.
Those fireworks. Yeah, that's right. They don't fly so good.
You know, you don't fly so good. Maybe you don't go south this winter.
That's right.
Take your chances here.
Back up north. But yeah. But so tell us when is the quail and there's more than like one auction at the quail, right? Like,
yeah,
so isn't that kind of like Pebble Beach when they have like multiple auction houses?
What all the auction houses kind of try to do is, you know, we're not going to just set up an island. Let's try to do this where it makes a little better sense. Although we don't always get along, there's certainly plenty of drama that goes on. That's really, really wish that, you know, some of that could... We need a reality show. I said this to someone recently.
It's probably going
to
happen.
We're talking
just
about
in between
it.
The auction, you mean in between the auction houses
like,
and
like
stuff?
Having some of the backdoor stuff that goes on, like it would be great
I can imagine the fight to try and get a vehicle into your auction.
I'm thinking reality shows, small cookies. I'm thinking we cast Will Ferrell. We do a full full movie.
I could just give him
they're on a writer's strike right now.
Yeah,
easy. We can scab our way in right now.
So what we do is generally, so Concours d'Elegance is what the fancy French word is for car show. Car show. We all go to car shows. It's a fancy car show with really crazy tickets to get in. And at the Quail is a golf club and resort and hotel. And it's owned by Michael Cadore, who is Sir Michael Cadore.
Knighted.
Mega billionaire from
England?
I'm assuming in England. Yeah. And he owns the majority of Monterey, California.
Huh.
And he flies around in his helicopter and visits all his friends. That's what he does the whole week.
He's the pilot. He flies himself.
No, he has people for that.
Okay. Yeah,
but he rides with them.
Well, Harrison Ford.
And he's a really lovely guy, I'm sure. But he owns all this stuff, and so he has the Quail Concours d'Elegance, which is the most expensive ticket you'll buy to go to a car show ever. It's $2,500 a person to get in.
Whoa.
And that does get you free caviar. It gets you top shelf drinks at 8 a.m. in the morning.
All you can eat, or is there a cap on
that? Yeah, I was going to say.
You know, they probably put a cap on you.
Because I'm going to wreck shop at $2,500.
I hear you. I mean, look.
I'm trash, so I'm lining Ziploc bags in my pocket.
It may be a bargain for you. They may stop you at the door. But it's crazy. And then so we have an auction that's right next door on the same property, along with the Pebble Beach Concours d'Elegance, the biggest car show in the world, most notoriable.
So that goes on at the same time?
That goes on Sunday. The Quail is on Saturday. We have auctions on Friday, starting Thursday with RM. RM's going to run, RM Sotheby's will run Thursday, Friday, and maybe Saturday. And then we'll have Gooding and Company is going to run, I think, Friday or Saturday. And what we all do is we do try to stagger things to some extent. Not to say that we really care who shows up at your auction, but we don't want to lose an auction, you know, midway through. We don't want to, you know, we try to keep
it's like a concert. You don't want to book the wrong bands at the wrong time.
It's a bit very delicate thing with somebody that has to deal with that.
But yeah, I can imagine.
We have a new auction house now in the mix called Broad Arrow that's now owned by Haggerty.
What do they specialize in? Anything? Just another house?
They're just trying to make money. And they're buying
all sorts of stuff.
They're buying Concours events so that they can control the whole thing.
Oh, monopoly!
And so there's a whole drama thing that happened with RM. They kicked RM out of a
For the pilot, man.
Oh, look, it's crazy. they kicked RM out of the Ritz-Carlton by just funneling money. They just paid until they said yes and kicked RM out of that. RM is run by a guy named Rob Myers, and Rob Myers is not the guy you want to mess with.
Yeah.
I feel like he's like, maybe they don't have a place to sleep at night.
He's closer to that than you think. Rob's a great guy. I love him to death. I promise, Rob, I love you to death.
But I would love him to death too. Love you, Rob.
That's the way it works. But no, it's always crazy. But we all try to, you know, it's easier to do when you're talking about trying to get massive amounts of people with lots and lots of disposable income into one place. You try to do it around areas where you know they're going to be interested to go.
Right.
And so it creates a whole thing.
Yeah.
You know, we have Car Week, Speed Week. We have, you know, this Amelia Island thing that goes on, and we have, you know, the Barrett Jackson auction has become, that's its own thing. And so they run 10 days and bring in a couple hundred thousand.
So questions. I was recently in Vegas. You were recently in Vegas. So you know what's happening in November. The Grand Prix is coming to Vegas.
Yes.
I watched this ridiculous tear up of streets and infrastructure that's happening from 3 years ago. They planned this.
Yes.
I think. Is there an auction surrounding that? There has to be.
There will be.
The tickets are $2,500 for the nosebleeds with nothing. Like you just to look out, you can't rent a room that faces the street for, I don't even want to know. Yeah.
So Bonhams is the official auction house of F1.
I would love to talk to you after the show.
So we have had an auction in Vegas. It began, we did it about 10 years ago as kind of a one-off thing. Then it was a regular motorcycle auction, which motorcycles, you know, as cool as they are, as rare as they are, a really expensive motorcycle is, you know, $100,000.
Right.
And there's very few of those. So most of them are going to fall less than 10,000 to somewhere
there's
between.
There's not enough meat on the bone for anybody.
Yeah. So it's usually,
really,
you know, $6,000 to $25,000 kind of on a really nice bike. And so there's not a whole lot of money in it. So it makes it very difficult to hold an auction because it's just expensive. Right. Everything about it, permits and people and travel and hotels. And it's just expensive.
Logistically, yeah.
I get it. So cars are where you make more money. I know that we are talking about what will be next as far as on a calendar basis. And it only makes sense. We're the official auction house. We know that we've got to have it. We do a big thing at Goodwood for the Festival of Speed.
Yeah.
That's our biggest European auction at the moment. And
So when you're in Vegas, what is the premier location for Bonham?
You know, I would probably, I mean, it would be the Bellagio. It would be Caesar's Palace, you know, something like that where they would attach
when
to.
Talking about Quail and you were talking about who you would get to attract. I mean, all over the world, this is like a first year thing for F1 in Vegas. They just unveiled the globe or the eye, whatever they're calling it. Have you seen that thing?
No.
Yeah.
It's scary.
My sister's got got tickets to the U2 at it. U2 is opening it. It's a big sphere.
Oh my god!
That is a big LED screen.
Google that. Right? It's amazing.
Oh, really? Go ahead, John.
Never mind. I'm good.
Just cut him off, Sean.
I'm just curious about the race itself. Where are they racing?
They're
on the streets of Las Vegas. On the strip.
Okay. Yeah, that's like, part of the strip.
So, I stayed.
It's gonna be a nightmare
Trump Tower, which is at the end of the I guess the eastern side of the strip, more new, and I'm facing away from the strip, and I'm looking down the whole time I was there for 4 days, and they're just chopping away at the street, and I'm walking and I can smell the tar, and I'm like, man, and they're talking about it. Over by that sphere, there's a whole F1 paddock that's already been where the pits are going to be.
Wow.
It's all flat and they haven't even erected it. Now, this is happening in November, but you know, money moves mountains. Right, so I was just like,
it'll get done.
The infrastructure has to.
Yeah.
But I was just thinking, like, that is the old mob still doing what it's doing.
It's not
has even, to be.
Well, I don't even think it's that.
Well, I don't even
really
know.
No, at this point, it's gotten government because F1 poles. There's so just so much money. I mean, everybody's fighting over having an F1 race.
Back to what I was saying before, like that would be not like I'm a business.
I love it. I'm going to take credit for that.
You should. Yeah. If it's not, I'll hook you up. I'll get my guy to get your guy. But like you're bringing people from all over the world with endless pockets that are so deep. I was curious if y'all had something lined up for November because of who's going to be there in the spirit of we got to have something that draws people in. Like what better time than already having an F1 race?
Yeah. And we actually have a fairly close. I don't. This is not me. I have a colleague that has a very close relationship with AMG. Along with Zach Brown over at McLaren. And so there has been, we sell a lot of F1 cars, retired cars,
right?
Some with running gear, some without. And so we've had a lot of involvement with them. And so this guy, Mark, that I work with, he has been a very big proponent of having an auction at an F1 event. And then when this came about, I mean, he was like, I can't even talk about it. So I'm assuming that this is in the works. And I'm happy to tell your fans about it. Because I'm
hurt. I was going to say, you're not going to get in trouble on YouTube or anything, right? We have a small thing. What, we out over there?
No, we're good.
So I have an interesting question. Well, I don't know if it's an interesting question, but I have just a question. So I believe it's Bonhams and maybe RM. They're both kind of English or whatever, right? Like
Bonhams is very English.
Yeah, Bonhams is English.
Oh, yes.
They, if I remember correctly, Bonhams is, they don't do like the blah, 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 blah. Like I can't remember the guy's, the auctioneer's name that normally does the stuff. Like when you see
Spanky Assiter is one of the, that was a Barrett Jackson guy, but he does that. Okay. We don't do that.
But no, that's what I mean. I was talking about the Bonhams.
Formula
who does his
that's
right, and he's like and he's like $1,000 to the gentleman,
yes,
blah blah blah, you know, and it's like, and it's not got that same kind of craziness to it, I guess, you know, whatever. Is there something to that with it being English or
sure,
or American where like, you know, maybe a car won't go sell as much because, you know, they have like, I must say, by the way, I like the Bonhams part better because I don't like all the blah, 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 all that stuff.
That's because you get overstimulated.
Yeah, I do.
It's exhausting.
That. That's my favorite part.
It is exhausting. Well,
from the TV, but if you had to swim in it, I'm pretty sure I'd be like,
sitting there watching. I was going to say, if you're sitting there watching it.
The new guy's trying to work out his sound.
An hour.
No, is that too much?
Well, what ends up happening, and this is at least what I find true about going to a live auction or watching it on TV. You know, I watch Barrett Jackson or Meekum, either one of those. The sing song is what I call it. I guess that's what it's called. But when they're moving in this repetitive auctioneer style, it's cattle call type of thing. It's a very American style way of doing it. And there's a rhythm and a purpose to it. It moves things along. It's exciting, blah, blah, blah. They have the lights and all this kind of stuff. When you're in it, it's confusion at times. But that usually works in the auction house's benefit.
Yeah.
Where, you know, there are people in the room that aren't paying can't follow it fast.
Right.
That just missed that it went to 30,000.
Like, and I'm raising my hand thinking I'm bidding 20 and I'm actually at 40.
Yeah.
And so,
and
they just take it and run.
I mean, it's the craps table.
Yes.
Any high stakes craps table.
And so,
and the house plays on that.
I was at Bear Jackson in Scottsdale this year and I was sitting there and I was sitting at kind of up high in the lounge up at the top and the back and I'm just watching. Because I'm trying to figure out, like, how in the hell can I bid on that car and know that what I'm bidding is what he's getting?
Right.
And I'm sitting there as somebody who does this for a living, and I'm going, I'm not raising my hand. Like, that would be terrifying.
Yeah.
And at Bonhams, the reason that I do my bid calling the way I do is because I had that happen where I've said yes. And responding to the auctioneer four numbers ago, and all of a sudden now I'm $25,000 or $50,000
over budget.
What I thought, my guy is sitting there going, "What the hell is that?" like you got to reverse that. I don't take it. Once it's done, it's done.
Yeah.
And so I said, "Okay, I'm going to be clear." So guy tells me I want to do, you know, $100,000, and I say you know, Rupert, sir, $100,000, and I'll call it from the back of the room. And it gives what it has done, and we've talked about this a lot, because there's a whole lot of talking that happens in the background of all this stuff, which I get exhausted with. But I'm just a slow boy from the South, and I'm selling used cars. Like, I have to move slower. And I have to move slower than even Rupert, the Englishman, will move at times. So it's important to me to know that I'm not screwing some guy out of, you know, thousands of dollars. And certainly when it gets into the big stuff, like, we have to be very, very clear, I feel like. And I feel like that's my responsibility as your assistant to bid on your behalf, is to make sure I bid what you want, and that we're not just randomly throwing numbers out, because they will randomly take them. I mean, they don't care. So
sales is sale.
And that's it. There's a million miles away from that auctioneer standing in the front of the room to the guy actually raising his hand.
So how do you get it? Do you get assigned an area or a book of people, or you're just standing there and some guy gets action on something?
So I've been, so we have a guy in this that stands in the front of the room, and he's literally just, anytime he sees a hand in the air, he yells and he's pointing to the guy, and Rupert's responsibility is to find it. So in our auctions, we usually have seating for about 2,500 people. So there's a bidders section, and there's a you know, spectator, the spectator section in the back, and bidders will sit back there at times when they just don't want to be seen.
Suites and stuff too, though, that you have to deal with?
No, okay. we have some VIP on the side. Usually that's for,
but it's still in the same area.
Yeah. Okay. So it's a fairly small, I mean, if you've ever seen a Barrett, the scale of what Barrett Jackson Scottsdale is mind-blowing.
Yeah.
By all accounts, like, it is its own city.
Right.
And the whole thing is fascinating to see how they do that. Meekum is a little different, where on TV it looks really, really big, and in person it looks kind of like what you'd expect at a smaller concert. Like, there's seating and they try to make it look full, but you know, I can yell in that room and somebody's going to hear me.
Yeah.
At Bonham's, it's so much more intimate. At RM, it's much more, you know, it's the same thing. They're going to hold probably about 3,000 to, we were about the same, I guess, because depending on what venue we're at, they're generally in hotels, or a hotel conference room, whatever the biggest conference room they have is what they'll take up.
Yeah.
Gooding and Company probably spends the most of all of us in their setup, because it is massive. And Gooding and Company is probably the number four or five, depending, you know, we all kind of bounce around with who's the number one each year, but Gooding & Company is not to be dismissed. They have multi-million dollars worth of cars every year, and they show up at all the big spots. But their tent is massive. I mean, it's the biggest traveling tent that we see on the circuit, and we don't really often compare ourselves to Barrett Jackson or Meekum. They're certainly by volume the larger ones, but they don't typically bring in the dollar value that we do with the same kind of work.
Well, because you're more pointed as far as the niche kind of stuff that you guys are doing.
You know, when you think about you know, it's business, it's cost, it's, you know, how little can we spend to achieve the most money, you know, return? And so it's expensive to rent one of these large tents with air conditioning and, you know, floors and, you know, comfy seating and all this kind of stuff and lighting, and, you know, everything's got to be perfect at all times and you can't have any mess ups. We have huge video walls and all this kind of crap. And I mean, it's $1 million, you know, to set up one of these things. And so, you know, I think Gooding and Company spends about three times that for Monterey. So, I mean, it's massive. But it's something that, you know, maybe not Monterey, because, you know, $1,000 a night for a hotel room, and, you know, you have to have reservations at restaurants in September of the previous year. Like, it's crazy.
That's not the organizers, though. I mean, that's just Monterey
being there.
That's Monterey just absorbing that.
And to get into any of these auctions, I mean, it's going to cost you $100, you know, generally maybe 150. Any of the outside events, which, you know, there's a lot of outside events. Those are all insane. To do a tour, you know, we've done tours. You get in your car and your own car and you drive it along with everybody else. Mm-hmm. And you go to some restaurant and you go see some sights and then you come home. So there's one that goes on there that's $18,000 for entering your own car. And so,
well, it's kind of like the mechanics are like, yeah, it's this price. And if you help, it's three times as much.
Yeah. $18,000 a car. So I can't imagine, like, it's just crazy.
But those people don't care.
They don't. Yeah. You know, those are the guys that are shipping their cars out there because they want something to drive while they go out and buy five more.
Yeah.
it's just, and there's plenty of them to do it. But it's an experience.
If you had, bottomless entertainment pockets, yeah. Why wouldn't you be like, come on, son, let's go do the thing.
If I won that $1 billion lottery, I'd be doing it.
Yeah.
You'd get half of that.
That's right.
The government wins every time.
But I'm still good.
It doesn't matter who wins.
That's right. I can still do that.
So you guys, for being the broker in that deal, you win from the buyer and the seller.
Yes. In general, yes.
You win twice, brother.
But if you have a collection of cars, if you have a group of cars, if you're going to sell a group of cars, think of a truck, because transporting cars is expensive. You get a better deal if you can fill a truck, where they're picking up at one location, delivering to another. So if you've got a large collection and you want to sell it with us, let's pick 6 cars at a time, because it just makes more financial sense that way. But
for everybody.
Yeah, for everybody.
Definitely.
So if you have a collection of cars, you can negotiate a better deal. If you've got, look, it all boils down to, what do you have? Are you selling it at reserve or no reserve? No reserve is going to get you a lot more favor, because we know we're going to sell it. If you're selling with a reserve, we may not. So,
So what was the most impressive car you've ever seen sold in the most derelict condition? I know it's an interesting question, because just say you saw that LT1 that we saw at Art and Speed, the black one, the Chevelle.
Yes.
And he was like, this is a $250,000 Chevelle and there's only blah, blah, blah. Let's say grandma got it after grandpa died and she just whatever, it went into disrepair. And nobody wanted to restore it. Would you guys take that car on if they just...
No.
It would have to be a concourse restoration?
No, it does not. Again, it really boils down to, what else are you selling? When I sold the museum, I often go back to that because it was such an incredible thing.
Yeah.
But they had an Owen Magnetic. And an Owen Magnetic was this really futuristic car of the 1910s. And this particular car was a shell of a car. To call it a car is a real stretch. It did have a block
was there,
and it had a chassis, and it was on wooden wheels, but the wooden wheels were all broken to pieces. And so there was just pieces of wheels that were on it. It did have a steering column and a dashboard, which was the most important part, because in an Owen Magnetic, there's a plate that's in the middle of the dashboard that gives you a serial number, and it matches the chassis and it matches the engine.
So it's a numbers matching
car, but it's a shell of crap.
So that's what I'm asking. You guys took that on?
We took it on.
Yeah.
No reserve. I can't remember exactly, but it was something to the tune of $80,000-$90,000 for this thing. And it was, you would have walked past it in the back here like it was just trash.
Yeah. I take offense to that, Sean.
I didn't say you're trash. I told you
I was trash.
There was another, but seriously, there are those kind of things.
I think we're done here.
And there's a Ferrari. If you go onto RM Sotheby's auction site, they are selling a crumpled, mashed potatoed, looks like two semi trucks, met and passion with this thing in the middle. It is sandwiched and elevated from the, both fenders are pointing north to the sky.
Wow.
This thing is trash. Ferrari? And the estimate on it is like $250,000 to $500,000.
So you got, I dream build stuff all the time. If in your world, you probably look maybe at Copart, because some of these supercars, they wind up in Copart.
Yeah, I don't want to buy a Copart.
Who doesn't want to do that? But they give it a shot. If you ever had a shot at maybe having your money halfway right, and you're like, I'm pretty savvy with a TIG welder. I could probably get that aluminum chassis straight. And I'll never be able to sell it for what it is. But I look at that. Some of those things sell for so much money. Like there was the 2005 version of the GT.
Yes.
Which is a beautiful, it's one of my dream cars.
It is the best modern supercar in existence.
And the value of that car, because you've been dealing with them, and I've just been a spectator from it. That car, when it came out, was, I think, $150,000.
It was $150,000.
Almost could mortgage a house to do that.
Sure.
That car is $500,000.
And it hits $600,000, $700,000, and $800,000.
Yes, depending on what it is. The Gas Monkey fellas took a Copart car.
Yeah.
if you remember that episode, yeah. And I know you watched
it.
Oh, right. Because yeah. they shit all over the industry and painted it black.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Put Air Ride, mega cool. Because why wouldn't you?
Sure.
This thing's got a salvage title, man. I'll do whatever I want to it.
That's
but
right.
Like, they're never going to. It's not an accurate representation.
But you do whatever you want for
right.
for
right. your
car.
Car. Right. It's your
if
car.
If you're going to sell it,
you got to get a.
Not the best idea.
Right,
I think we've proven
but
that.
We knew that the chassis was cracked on that. They wound up getting a subframe or something. They welded back together. I just.
Yeah.
So that was my original question was, what's the biggest turd you're willing to take?
You know, the glorious part about this
it's
is
not
that
sitting back there.
Mr. Bottoms.
It's not sitting back there.
Right. Yeah. Mr. Bottoms.
So
Rupert's not doing
that. I've turned him on to some things that were not running and he ain't taking.
Well, you know, and there's a whole thing of, you know, I look at every opportunity as what's the best for everybody involved. So if you come to me and you say, you know, my mom's, you know, inherited her dad's collection of whatever and I want to sell it, I generally have an idea of how to do that. I have, you know, certainly some great people that I know that deal in all different types of stuff. So it may not be a fit for a Bonhams type of auction. And Bonhams is not what you think it is. And I'm talking about some of this stuff, but the truth of the matter is we have no reserve cars. We have, you know, $30,000-$40,000 cars at every sale.
Yeah.
We have hot rods. We have, you know, muscle cars, you know, they're generally pretty good, but, but we will take them and we'll do that. And, but it has to make sense for everybody, depending on where you are, what kind of condition is the car. And, you know, what do I think I can have as buyers that will meet your expectations? And the hardest thing is when you sell a car and you know you didn't meet the expectations and the guy had to sell it because it was no reserve.
Well, he probably was strapped anyway. That's why he wound up on your doorstep.
You never know. And sometimes that's the case and sometimes it's not. But I do have a conscience. I do try to do the right thing for these people. And if nothing else, I'm usually a good resource. And I'll point people to bring a trailer if it makes more sense there.
Yeah.
I've got no skin in that game, but I have an elderly gentleman that, you know, gotten up in age and he had five cars that he hung on too long. And he said, you know, now I don't know what to do because I don't know how to sell these cars anymore. I used to know all the people that were in the clubs and all
they're all out now.
And so I literally went in and said, well, this one's going to go to Bonhams here, and this one's going to go to a Barrett Jackson sale, and this one's going to go on Bring a Trailer, and this one we're going to put on Marketplace and see what happens.
Yeah.
And so, you know, you have to be very nimble in some of this stuff because every situation is different. Sean knows about this situation. I had a lady who was a widow in Mississippi, and she had 50 cars that were that she was selling. She had someone who was helping her that was not actually helping her, but allowing cars to be sold for, you know, insane cheap prices.
Yeah.
And he was getting some kickbacks for it.
I'm sure.
And I stopped the whole thing in the middle of
Thank God.
And I went in and I just said, you know, I talked to the lady instead of going to talk to the people. And I said, you know, look, I've dealt with this before. I can help you. But it's going to mean that
we take over.
I have to take over.
Yeah.
And that's the way I work. I have to have custody of it. I have to take over. And if you want me to do that, I'm happy to do it. I understand if you don't. She said, please help.
Yeah.
And so I've shuffled everybody out of there, pissed off a lot of people. Some people are still mad at me.
So you guys are a pretty healthy legal department over there.
Like, yeah, they're great. I need that. Actually.
I mean, that was the next question.
I keep them very busy.
There was a word there. When you were telling me, explaining that. Uh-huh. When you say the word custody,
yeah,
all I heard was judge and gavel.
That's right.
Like,
yeah.
Outside of the auction house gavel, there was a judge gavel.
So custody is a big thing.
That's a huge word.
Paperwork and custody mean everything.
Yeah.
But it also requires a great deal of trust. And so, you know, I am not the most knowledgeable about any one car. I have general good knowledge about a lot of cars. But what I am really good at is people. I can
find the right person that knows that.
Yeah. And so, I'm quick to say that I don't know everything. But I'm very trustworthy. I do what I say I'm going to do. I do. It's one of those things. Thank you, mom and dad. I generally, you know, especially when it's a widow, especially when it's a, you know, passionate family that has, you know, ties to these things that they know they have to let go of. It's a hard thing. It's an emotional thing. And I try not to lose sight of that because so many people do. We've all dealt with people in the car business that have really screwed up the whole business in general by just being rip-off crooks.
Well, just being there.
Just not being there.
Thanks for showing up, jerk.
And so I find it, you know, a great opportunity to not be that.
Yeah.
To be honest with people, look, I'm going to make money on this. Like, I don't do this for free. I am not a charity. I have to be paid to do this. And the more you pay me, the better I work for you. That's not really true.
That's not true. I'm not a charity.
I'm going to start using that on you now.
Maybe one day UNICEF will get into the auction house business.
Sean, really, it's all we have is like.
Thanks for bringing this guy, Sean. He's a real joy.
But you know, you have a responsibility, and these people give you the keys to their very expensive sometimes cars, and they have to be able to trust you, and you have to be able to be trustworthy. Wow. You know, Sean and I took off for 60 miles and nearly $1 million car, and the owner never questions it.
Yeah.
And he says, you know, have fun. Make sure you go, you know, it likes to shift at 4,000 RPMs. Yeah. Okay, great. Thanks.
Make sure you bang six.
Yeah. He's like, you know, it's one of those, but he knows I'm going to be an adult. I've always been an adult around his cars. I don't, you know, whenever.
I never got a ride in it, by the way.
It's true. I think he did try to get me to take
I rode next to it. That's right. Like this in the fair lane with the camera like this.
You know the suspension isn't tight on him. He shouldn't be driving anywhere near his
car. The whole time I'm riding next to him, I'm like, oh my God, this is a really expensive car.
Well, he started it and he pulls over really quick and he goes, I need my hand wrap for this. And, you know,
he's
hanging.
Well, yeah, because I've got my camera.
He wanted a moving shot.
So rolling shots. Yeah, I was just hand holding it. I didn't have anything.
You need a lab assistant.
Well, I didn't have anything to hold it on if I dropped it.
You're perjuring yourself, sir.
That thing has a battery pack on it, and with the lens and the battery pack on it, it's like heavy. 10 pounds. Yeah, it's like 10 pounds. So I'm holding it one handed like this while I'm driving like this, and I'm trying to shoot you can't do it, you know. So I was like, after a while, it's like all the pictures kind of went like that. And so
that's Auto Enthusiast Network for all your photography. Yeah.
The photos came out amazing.
I'm sure they did.
We got a couple good ones.
You got the moving shot off that?
Yeah.
I bet that's cool.
Yeah,
I love blur on everything and hyper focus on the actual car.
Yeah. Yeah. We did. We got a few. Out of the 1,000 I probably took it.
Sean's, if anything, but thorough.
Yeah.
He's definitely thorough.
Well, and you know, photographing a car is one thing. A lot of people can do it. Photographing a car in the middle of the day in bright, you know, cloudless skies is a real challenge. And this car has two different, you know, completely different paint shades of bright white, and then it's got a dark blue stripe in the middle of it. So, you know, how do you do that?
And a really laid back windshield.
Yeah, and a laid back windshield. There's a lot of glare.
Trying not to get the glare.
So he did a great job of capturing everything.
You got to find a canopy. Find us some shade. But
we wanted it in the bright.
Yeah.
Because it has pearl white.
Oh, yeah.
And then it's iridescent pearl blue. A pearl blue.
It's tough.
And you wanted to be able to show that pearl to it. So I was like, yeah, we're going to have to.
Rarest Ford color, big story, the Mystic Pearl.
Wait, what?
Isn't that
the Mustang color?
The Mustang color.
I don't know.
I know you hate it. It's
like Chrome Illusion.
It looks like the Doughboy car.
The Chrome Illusion.
The Doughboy cars look like that. That's a rare color. Look it up, man. He knows. You've seen it before.
That's funny.
It's a story to the car you were bringing up earlier, the supercar, the new GT.
Yeah.
Someone paid Ford extra money to paint that car that color.
So
you know the story.
Yeah. So Ford is interesting.
They
will, depending on who you are and your ability to help them in some way through probably social media is their big thing these days. He and I have a friend that did this where he said, you know, I'm going to buy your car. However, I would like it a different color than you offer. And they were like, well, okay. And it's just dollar bills.
Yeah.
But they won't do that for everybody, but they will do that for certain people.
So you had to be invited to buy that car.
Yeah. So
initially off the top.
You could apply.
Well, there was a list. I think Leno was like called. I think they called him.
Yeah. I mean, the majority of people were invited. Right. I mean, once they get through that list of people that they've invited and see how many they have left.
Then it goes open to the public.
We'll see what's worth now.
Sean.
The funniest thing about that particular car that I'm talking about, that he had painted a different color. He had it painted a Volkswagen color.
What color was that?
It was a gold color.
Terrible.
Yeah.
Continue.
It actually came out really, really cool.
See? He flip-flops on me. I'm trying to be on his team.
I know. But yeah, some of these things, you know, there's all kinds of stuff that happens behind the scenes.
I was impressed by so that color, begrudgingly, he won't admit it. You know that's a rare color on a Mustang from the factory.
Yeah.
There wasn't a whole lot of them. This guy got invited, the story goes, to buy that car. And then paid like an obscene amount of money to Ford to spray it. Anybody can go to any hood place and get something sprayed.
Sure.
Like Ford painted the exact color code.
Yeah, which, you know, there's a great deal of value in having the factory do that.
So one, what are the odds of a car like that making it across the auction block?
Oh,
that's high.
That's,
I would think, right?
Why you would do that.
Yeah. This is why I bring this up.
That,
are you guys excited at the possibility of that hitting the market? That particular,
the one that we know of,
not the gold one, the Mystic, the Mystic Chameleon Flippy Floppy Pango.
No, and here's why.
Because it's not a desirable.
It's not a desirable.
It's, you know, ugly.
If they
drug dealers are doing a lot of good stuff, no, these
like limelight pink isn't a desirable color. Right. And if they built only one, thank you for only building one.
You got a pink hater,
and that's really. I mean, that's what it boils down to. Is you know, yes, rare can be valuable.
I'll tell the American Breast Cancer Society.
Yes, right. This is helping me a lot.
Well, there's
going to get a lot of leads out of this call.
Right.
I was going to say, there's also history behind the gold one.
Yes.
A reason that it was that color, right? Because it matched. I mean, we could say who it is.
Okay,
it's George Poteet's car, right? So it matches his Land Speed car.
Oh, that's a different animal.
Yes.
So
that is a different.
Yeah. So I'm glad that you felt okay to say it. We've had him on the podcast.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
I think we were the first.
We were the first. Thank you again, George.
Nice.
Yeah. Thank you, George.
He's on his way out there now.
Yeah, exactly. So. But no, so it was his car. And so he paid extra to get it painted that color.
The demon.
A lot extra to get it painted the same color. It's the gold that matches the speed.
Do you know the name of that color?
What car?
It's a Volkswagen
Ford,
color.
The Ford GT.
Oh, yeah.
So he had a Ford GT.
He sold it.
Yeah. And then the other thing was...
I did.
So the other,
I know who's, I know.
Yeah, I know where it went. Yeah. So the other thing with that one is that they would not paint stripes on it.
Right.
Because he wanted the flat stripes, the flat gold stripes.
Oh,
so they wouldn't do that. But that went to Rad Rods by Troy, and Troy
took care of it.
And Troy painted the stripes on it.
Yeah, 99%.
And then he also has one-off wheels on that.
Yeah. Magnesium wheels.
Yeah, magnesium wheels, one-off magnesium wheels that match the original.
True knockoffs.
Knockoff wheels.
That were period correct, you know, period style.
For the GT.
Yeah.
For the GT.
Some people like it, some people don't.
I don't know. I think that's awesome.
Well, I mean, it's different. So that was what was really cool about it, because like most of those cars, like nobody wants to touch them.
The hardest complaint I had because I did try to sell that car for him. And everybody I talked to that were really interested in the car struggled with the stripes. And so, you know, this is one of those situations where you can go too far. And it would have been best to leave the paint alone and then just do a sticker stripe. You know, that's just, it would have been better to wrap it or whatever.
Just do a vinyl stripe. But
I don't see Poteet doing
it. There is no way that George Poteet's
going to put a vinyl sticker.
He's not going to cut a corner.
No.
And it's true of everything that he touches is just to a new level.
Well, it's that long vision we talked about.
And he doesn't think about, he's not concerned about resale value.
Yeah, he didn't care
if he made money.
That's right.
He did make money on that car, but
he did.
What was that 32 he had? That Mike was drooling over, the green one.
No, I sold that one to Dwayne Carini.
That's the mole car.
Yeah. The mole car.
Yeah.
So one of the most beautiful old
one-off
cars I've ever seen.
You say the other one?
You can say the other one.
Yeah, you also sold the Torino Talladega. Yeah.
That was you?
Yeah.
I got to touch that car.
Yeah, I got to drive it.
Matt, I know a guy that got to ride in.
Wayne bought it.
I did know that. He bought it in a package, didn't he?
Yeah. So
thanks for brokering that.
Yeah, no problem.
That was at the reunion, and that was actually my first.
So I just recently told him, and you know, when you talk about dream cars, you know, one of the problems with doing this is that you come across a new dream every day. and you get to meet some of these people. You know, George Poteet is not somebody that you really get to know quickly. It takes a long time for that relationship to build and become what you would call a friend. And I'm not sure I'm there yet, but I really like the guy. And I get to go by every once in a while and sit and just talk bullshit. And he lets me drive whatever I want to. And he takes me for rides and things. And I'm, you know, we were screwing around one day and Wayne was in town. And so we went over there and we're driving around and I was driving. And I thought to myself, in George and his George way says, you know, that right foot ain't for suggestions. And so I looked over and I was like, you know, George, let's just take a moment and realize that in the news article that will come out when I've crashed this car and everyone is dead, like it will be some guy was driving these two guys.
Yeah.
And like it will not. It will not be good. And God forbid I live, because, you know, that would just not be good.
Yeah. If he was driving, it would be Wayne Cree and the other guy.
I have had this nightmare a number of times when I'm riding in a car with somebody that's of some kind of popularity.
And that's where your brain goes.
You just. I
killed him.
I am forgettable and I will just be blamed. You know, Kevin Hart's the perfect
example. We remember, sadly, that Paul Walker passed away. Nobody knows the guy that killed him.
Driving,
right? And that's the scenario that runs through your mind?
That's right.
When you're...
That's the one. My so kids will ridiculous. Be like, wait a minute, Dad was in that too, wasn't he? Yeah. But
they mentioned that guy first and then you...
But it is great fun and we have some great stories. I've met some really amazing people. I've had some people who just really surprised you that you think, you know, that guy's going to be a real dick. And he's wonderful. And then you've had the ones that you go, I bet that guy's really great. And you go,
not so great.
Whoops, never doing that again. Now you just got to treat everybody on even keel. But it is great fun. It is great responsibility. And I'm so blessed to be able to live out my dream to do this. And if you're interested at all in selling your car, please reach out to me.
Yeah. I was just going to say, how do people get in touch with you? How they learn about Quail, whatever. Is it just Bonhams?
So you can always go to Bonhams.com or it's Bonhamscars.com now, I think. But type in Bonhams.com and it'll get you there. You can always reach out to me on Facebook, Stephen Mancuso. And if you know how to get in touch with Sean, he knows how to get in touch with me.
You can get in touch with me.
He'll filter them all.
Yeah, I know a guy. That kind of stuff. Yeah. Yeah.
Auto enthusiast.
Just don't tell him if you have like a valuable car because he's going to want something out of it.
Yeah.
He's going to want to take a picture of it and charge him money.
I told him that Ferrari, I'll shoot it for just 1%.
Yeah.
Just 1% of the sales. No big deal.
That's not a problem.
I mean, no problem.
Wouldn't be a bad deal.
It's 1%.
Deal.
Who else has for 1%?
I know. It's nothing. It's practically nothing.
Nothing.
I'm with you, fellas.
Yeah.
Man, well, thanks for coming out.
Thank you all very much.
It's been awesome. Wind it down, but
it's been really cool, though, because, I mean, you know, we're used to doing the just regular car guy kind of stuff, but you're in that different echelon as far as what you deal with.
I'm in a different echelon.
You're in a different part of the industry. I mean, this is kind of like it you is. Pull back. So exactly. Really, like, nobody sees the wizard, no way, no how. Like, you pull back the curtain a little bit.
Yeah.
And there's a little mystery that's had now been solved.
Yeah. Very cool.
In a non-creepy 90s show.
That's right.
Yeah. And you'll have to give us a report on how Quail goes.
Yeah.
And what my percentage is.
I don't know if they probably charge me to watch that on TV. That sounds like a really expensive.
I've got a helicopter parking spot just for you.
Oh, perfect. That's awesome.
And you're not worried about dying in a helicopter crash with a famous person.
I don't get in those things. Are you crazy?
There you go.
That's awesome.
That's great.
All right, Javi, it's your turn.
I think he's a radio guy. I think really
he does have a really good.
He's got a real force for radio.
You gotta tell him how to do it.
No, do a really good old timey voice.
Can you do old timey voice?
What are you talking about?
Okay, that's porn voice. I don't need that.
That's Harry 70 porn guy.
I can do waka 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 waka.
No way, dude.
Yeah,
go ahead.
He said, "Hey, Peter, man, the breast exams on channel 3." Do that, Jesus, Lawrence. Do that. Jeez, Lawrence. All right, this has been Hot Rod Blues.
There you go.
This has been Hot Rod Blues.
Coming to you live. See, that's how you sound. Like a trucker.
That's right.
Like a trucker pre-emphysema trucker. That's right.
That's what I was looking for.
All right. Awesome. We'll see you guys. Thanks for tuning in.
Thanks, everybody. Bye. Yes.